Okay.
All right. We are ready to go. Well, thank you very much, everyone, and welcome to our May 2016 Story Lab featuring our speaker today, Lori Silverman. I am very excited to have Lori join us. She has a lot of wealth of information to share. And Lori and I first met many, many years ago via the phone, actually, so similar to a conversation we'll be having today, around a book she was writing at the time that started Wake Me Up When the Data's Over. And I'll let her explain a little bit more about that, too. But from that very moment in time, I really felt like she got it. She understands what, you know, storytelling is, you know, in organizations. And so we're delighted to have her here. For those of you that don't know, Lori has done a lot in the way of writing. She's also recently written a part of the Dummy series. I have the book sitting right here, Business Storytelling for Dummies, who she wrote, co-authored with Karen Dietz, who's actually on our call as well and has been a past speaker with our group. And she has worked with a number of different companies throughout the country and across the globe, including Wells Fargo and Target and Chevron and Lucent and you know, a few organizations that you may have heard of. So, Lori, I would, you know, again, thank you for your time and for sharing your wisdom with us. And I would love to open it up for you to maybe introduce yourself a little bit, and then we'll get started.
Thank you. I think I'm going to go back because Karen's on the call. I think this is always kind of a fun memory for us to have. I had finished writing a book, co-authoring a book called Stories Trainers Tell in 2003, and that's when I met Karen Dietz. And we ended up having, and Karen always has more detail about this than I do, but we ended up meeting for lunch one day in Palm Desert to talk about something that I had heard on radio and TV shows when I was promoting the book Stories Trainers Tell. And this really was a moment in life for me that was quite a turning point. And I told her that I had been hearing over and over again people talking about one question, can story be used for things other than training? And she and I talked about that maybe, you know, we should do a little bit of research online and look at whether or not there had been other applications. Karen had been involved in the field for a lot longer time than I had done. And what I discovered along with her was that there hadn't really been all that much written other than some of Steve Denning's books. And that sparked the book that, Mark, that you mentioned, Wake Me Up When the Data is Over, where I set out, and Karen, when she was with the National Storytelling Network, supported this book as a sponsor, is we set out to look for 100 organizations across the world in 2004 who were using story. I always say, suffice it to say, 3 years later, with 81 organizations under our belt and me running out of money, I just said, we can't do this anymore. I said, two people died on the project, and that was enough for me. We turned that into a book that today really still has some amazing gems of examples in it. We looked for 5 examples of the use of story across multiple business functions. And then one of the things that came out of that book that has still sparked my work today is a real desire to push forward with how can story become an organizational core competency. And as I said to groups of CEOs I was working with last week, you know, in the field of technology 30, 40 years ago, we used technology on desktop computers just as a set of tools. I mean, we knew how to do word processing. Maybe you had Lotus Notes or something else. And from there, you know, the field of technology really has grown to become a competence that organizations today cannot live without. And I really think that story is still in the infancy that technology was at many, many decades ago. And my goal, my legacy, will be to really push that forward so that people do see its value in every single business function and why it needs to be integrated into the DNA of the organization. When Karen and I wrote the Dummies book, we once again searched for companies who were doing what I had hoped is the ideal, and unfortunately, we still could not find any. So I think that that goal is still quite elusive and is out there and is really what I'm trying to encourage leaders to strive for. Is to use story more than a tool technique approach, but to really think about its strategic applications within organizational settings.
That's great to understand, and it really pretty much sets us up for conversation. You know, you've traveled across the country, you've worked in many industries, you've worked for large and small organizations, you've written a lot, you've touched a lot of different groups. Is there a common theme or issue that you've seen challenging organizational leaders when it comes to influencing others? And you know, because I think it kind of starts there, right? It's all about influence.
Well, I think the biggest issue I'm seeing today is the one that was featured in a New York Times Sunday magazine several weeks ago, maybe now several months ago, and that's this whole issue around psychological safety. Google's been doing a lot of research on teams, and one of the real challenges is that if we cannot create psychologically safe organizations, we don't really have the ability for people to connect, and if people can't connect, then we don't have the ability to build trust, and then from there, we can't really build influence and so forth. And so one of the things I've been working on more than I thought I would be at this point in time is that whole arena around how do we create environments where people feel safe to contribute, safe to open up, safe to talk about what's on their mind. Because if we can't do that, we have no ability to influence whatsoever. And then my work in influence, because I do a lot of teaching in that area, keeps coming back to two other pieces and that I think we forget, and that is that, you know, the number one tool of influence is a person being likable. And I think story plays a significant role in that because I can't be likable if I don't choose to be vulnerable. And through telling a story or through prompting one from someone else, I can increase, the ability to show my humanness and also encourage others to do the same. So I think we're kind of still at the fundamentals in some way. I mean, as advanced as we'd like to be, I think we still have a lot of challenges in that arena.
Mm. That's really very interesting. So tell us about some of the latest work and experiences that you've been having then around that and how story has impacted, you know, some of those organizations, or especially around creating that psychological safety.
And Mark, can I just jump in? Sorry to interrupt. There's some, at least a couple of people must have their phones unmuted, and there's a lot of background noise. So if I could just remind people, if you just hit *6 for the purpose of this call, it will mute you and then unmute you. Just *6. It's an easy way to do it. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll continue on.
Thank you.
Sure. I want to talk about one organization that I've been doing a lot of work in and in story. The psychological safety piece has been more recently, but I want to go back a couple of years when I was asked to work with a technology group in an organization, and they don't have an internal strategic plan. They have an external strategy, which is widely well-known in the community that they serve and by their constituents. But internally, there really isn't a strategy for how to go about implementing what the external strategy says. And I was brought in to do a change impact assessment. And what I did, a piece of this, because my background is as a strategist and I also do work in large, messy changes, is I said, you know, I don't normally just craft vision stories. Usually I look for external environmental scan data to help us craft a vision story. I said, in this case, I think what I'd like to do is the gentleman I was working with had been in the organization a year, and as he would say, he had taken them from like the 18th or 19th century to the 20th century and just really wanted a plan for the next 3 years to go from the 20th century to the 21st century. And I said, well, you have a lot of pain already. I said, so maybe what we need to do is co-create a vision story for what the future of technology would look like, sound like, be like for a middle-level manager. And so they created this amazing story around a singular woman character who had lost a highly tenured employee and yet was able, through all of the new technologies that were in place, to find a new hire, and that hire had been in the organization before, so now he was coming back and reflecting on how different things are and how cool is this, and it's so much better to be here than it was in the past. And when we were finished writing that story, and I did not help him, he worked with a number of other leaders in the organization to put it together. We shopped that story, and what you might know as socializing a story. He and I took it out to all the people who had not contributed to its initial writing. And we got their feedback on it, just initial reactions. Tell us what you thought about when you read this. You know, tell us what's missing. What sorts of things in here really resonated with you and what sorts of things would you like us to change and so on. And we made the adaptations to the story. And then we did something kind of unique is we extrapolated 9 major programs and projects from that vision story once we had agreement that that was really the future that everyone wanted. And about 2 months ago, it was in April when I almost 2 months ago when I was on site with this gentleman and another company who I'm bringing in to work with us, he was asked the question about this, what has your strategy been and what sorts of projects have you had and what sorts of success would you attribute to what you've done? And he said, I can honestly say that this vision story and the 9 programs and projects that came out of it had 100% success. We had no failure. And I didn't even know that myself, because I had been away from the organization for a little bit of time, but it really struck me how powerful a singular story can be. But he reminded me of that again in December. So now I'll go back about 6 months when he wanted to reengage me and asked if I could come in to do some training I had done in the past on what I call a variety of emotional intelligence topics for his staff around the MBTI type and temperament, around 9 behavioral expectations that the employees in technology and in administrative services had come up with, how to give feedback, how to do coaching, change impact assessment, and so on. And his staff had grown over 30%. And I said, well, if you're going to have me come in to do this work, I'd like to start out my work in January with you. It's going to be the second week in January. I said, I'd like you to tell a story. I said, so since the vision is kind of over now, as we've been through the 3 years, and again, I heard about the results and the success in April, I said, what's your theme for 2016, given that I know you're moving as an organization this year, you've got a lot of immediate, what I call mission-driven priorities rather than vision-driven priorities. And he said to me, well, my theme is to take things to the next level. And I said then, okay, I would like you to tell a story. I said, it would be nice if it's a personal story, but it could be an organizational story, too, around a time in your life when you took things to the next level. And he and I decided that it would be a personal story and a personal story that no one, including me, knew about. We crafted it together over the holidays at the end of the year. He told that story the morning of the Monday of the second week in January. And the reason this is important to me is the theme, take things to the next level, is not the key point of a story. And I think that's a real distinction for people. You can't tell a story where the outcome is, oh, take it to the next level, because that does not tell people what to do differently. And this is something that Karen and I have really spent a lot of time talking about, is that, stories in business are only useful when they move people to action. But you have to give people something to action. And so the key point of this story was you – 3 things. You need to commit, admit, and follow through. And the commitment, you need to commit to doing something different. You need to admit your fears along the way so that people can help you through them. And then you need to follow through on your commitment. And the personal story he told was so shocking, I think, to people in the room that they not only were engaged in the story, but we decided to debrief it afterwards. In terms of what did you hear, what did you learn, tell us about the meaning of the story for you. And people talked about it for almost 20 minutes and was really insightful because it gave him as a leader some feedback on what his employees thought about that story and him. And it really was for the first time his ability to be vulnerable and open to his staff, especially in a time that we knew was going to become more stressful. And someone in the room said something absolutely, it was kind of funny. They said, oh, you know, since all of our performance appraisals are going to be in the next couple of weeks, are you integrating this key point into our performance appraisals? And he takes improv classes, the guy I work with, and he's like, yes, we are. We're going to talk about what commitments you're making, what fears or anxieties you might have, and how you're planning to follow through and how we can help you. But we also did something else that I just love to do is, after we did the debrief, we had employees pair up, and they know how to do story sharing. They had done this a couple years earlier, where we give them the same story prompt, you know, tell us about a time in your life when you needed to take things to the next level. And then we have them listen, as Doug Littman would say, delightedly to the story that they hear, and then talk about the meaning of those stories. And what we captured for leadership to work on was a whole series of things to help support employees through the next year in terms of all the changes that they were going to go through. And that story continues to have legs today. So for me, just the continuing theme of how do we contextualize story? You know, this is storytelling cannot stand on its own. It can only, for me, it can only be used within a context. And I think that's the hardest thing for organizations to understand, because I will get calls all the time from people who say, ah, just come in and teach us, you know, a half day on storytelling. And I say, well, to what end? And they're like, what do you mean to what end? Well, do you want me to talk about story relative to strategy? Do you want me to talk about story relative to change? Do you want me to talk about story relative to prospecting and sales? I mean, relative to what context? And just like our call today, you know, story relative to how to transform data into story, wow, you know, that's its own animal, so to speak. There are whole different sets of steps. And I don't think yet that we're sophisticated enough to understand these distinctions in organizations. I think business leaders are real naive. And last week was a real testimony to this when I had the opportunity to talk to three different groups of CEOs in Washington, D.C., and were able to get their feedback. And it was 100% consistent, which is, oh, my gosh, we had no idea the story has to be used inside of a context. Number two, we had no idea that just finding and crafting a single story has to be done in a meaningful, mindful, and thoughtful way. And number three, thank you for opening our eyes to the possibilities of what can be. So I feel like we're doing this one person at a time, if that makes any sense. You know, at least for me it does. It's like I got to put one foot in front of the other and say one more on the bandwagon, you know. But I do have a concern that I just want to share along with us. I really think, and Karen and I spent some time on this, I think that the real challenge in our industry is, and I don't know if this pig wants to take it on. I know that we have tried to take it on. I started in 2004 and have kind of decided to go a little bit different direction. I think our field is going to remain where it is until we agree on a common definition of story in the field of business. Right now, we don't have that. And we are the only industry that doesn't have standards, a standard definition. That's my take on it. You may disagree with me. But it poses a tremendous number of problems. That means that when I go, as I'm doing right now, I'm talking to an organization about doing a couple of half-day workshops on story. You know, they come back to me and say, well, you're making it too difficult. I'm not making it too difficult. I'm basing the steps that I'm going to teach on the definition of story that I believe is what creates a story. And until we start to really distinguish for people between forms of narrative, you know, anecdotes are not the same as a story. Neither is an example, neither is a description, neither is a vignette, neither is a case study, neither is a profile or a testimonial. Until we do that, I think that we are going to be spinning our wheels a little bit in organization. We need some level of foundation to be able to climb above this so that we can together co-create some new tools and methods. But again, that's just me sharing the challenge that I think is still out there along with some of the opportunities and possibilities.
Well, that's great, and that's very very germane to what we are looking to gather in the way of information about how to be better practitioners around all of this. So thank you for sharing your experience on that. I want to just maybe see if anybody has any questions before I ask you to maybe Tell us a story or two that you like to use with others, and whether it's yours or somebody else's or whatever, but you've been exposed to so many, maybe there's one or two that you could share. But first, any questions from the group?
The definition of story.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, wanted to know more about how you're defining it.
Karen, you want to talk about that at all, because we used your definition, or is she with us?
Sure. Although you could do it just as well,
I have it. But I have to tell you that this woman, I look to her because we've worked so hard on this definition, and Karen has really been what I call the guidepost for me in all of this. So I would appreciate if you could just take a minute, and then I'm more than happy to jump in.
Sure, sure. So basically now, this is me and Lori, too, now. I have one convert in the world. but for me, there's a distinction between two basic types of definitions for story. And one definition focuses on, what constitutes a story? Well, you have a beginning, a middle, end, you have emotions, you have contrast, you have a key message, you have characters, you have, maybe some dialogue. Anyway, there's a list, right, of the key elements. And that's all well and good, that works. My preference for a definition is one that actually focuses more on the results that a story produces. So I like a definition that goes something like this, and we have it in the book. I'm doing this from memory. But it's basically a story is a set of packets of sensory information. Right? A story is made up of packets of sensory information that people can easily digest and make meaning of or from that. And sensory packets of information is basically just those triggers that we have to trigger sight, sound, taste, smell, feelings, and the five senses. And so that's more of an experiential definition than a laundry list. And I like working with the experiential definition because then it helps people in business understand, we're doing this for some purpose, right? Not to check a laundry list of things. And we all know as storytellers that a laundry list is great, but it doesn't help you craft a really good story. But maybe if you're paying attention to the experience people need to have from the story, it will help you create a much better story. So that's just my two cents worth and what Lori and I have written about for a number of years. So I hope that makes sense for everybody.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
There's one other thing that I would like to add is that to Lori's point about, hey, we need some standards, we need a definition of story that we can all agree on. And I think that it is okay to have more than one definition of what a story is, so long as we all agree on when we are going to use a particular definition. So if I'm teaching a class on how to craft a story, there are times when I'm going to share the definition that's here's the laundry list of elements. And there are also times that I'm going to share the experiential definition. And, in fact, I might share both. But I'm very clear that I have a particular application and a task in front of me to do. And so I could use a definition of story that meets my objectives. And so I hope that makes sense, too. Okay, I'm done.
Yes, and if I might comment on that, Karen and I are in agreement on that because, to me, both of those elements, I think, produce the whole. They're kind of the yin and yang of each other. But I think the piece that people tend to glom onto are the elements pieces. What they forget is, what is the experience need to be? And this becomes even more critical when we start talking about meaning making. Because one of the things that we really spend a lot of time distinguishing on and become critical when you talk about transforming data into story is that there is a difference between something making sense and creating meaning from it. And there's a line, and people, and we're not seeing that line, for example, with data scientists, you know, who are creating these beautiful visualization charts and graphs and you name it. I mean, I just had 5 more interviews today about this particular subject with people, and they think that that's sufficient as messaging. And what we've come to recognize is that it's not. What people are missing is, what's the meaning in the data? What's that data saying to you? What voice does it have? And how can we start to craft that story that goes around those elements? So for us, I don't think that this is a trivial point, I guess, because both are critical. And the experiential piece is even far more critical when we start talking about what do we do with data.
Cool. So, Lori, would you mind sharing a story or so with us? Maybe one of your favorites or ones that you found to be impactful?
Yeah, there's one in particular that I've been using for a lot of years. It's in my in our 2003 book. And I actually now use it again in the Transforming Data into Story workshop because, for me, it now has a home. It's taken me a lot of years to figure out, why do I love this story so much? My friend Larry English is considered to be a guru in the information quality arena, so much so that in the year 2000, the American Society for Quality said that Larry is one of 21 people that you and I are supposed to get to meet in this century, because he just has such a profound message to share with us. And as a result of his fame and notoriety, Larry was asked to work in a very large insurance company in the U.S. that wanted to understand its risk going forward. So he was smart enough to put together a team of internal staff to work with him, and what they decided to do was to gather 5 years of historical data on medical diagnosis codes, and they went to each region of the company and downloaded all that data, made certain they had the right information. They synthesized it all together, then they did a bunch of different analyses, and they came together into a meeting to look at it. And Larry's kind of sitting there. He's like, oh, man, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this data. I mean, this report's just so interesting. You know, hey, folks, you know, I want to call this meeting to order today. I know that all of you have had that chance to, I'm hoping you've had a chance to look at this report that I sent you, and I'm wondering what your immediate reactions are to it. Well, Larry, something's wrong. I mean, something's really wrong. Yeah, I agree with Larry. You know, I mean, something doesn't seem quite right. And on this conversation went until this tiny little voice in the back of the room said, well, you know, I know something doesn't seem quite right, but maybe before we take any action, could it be that we collected the data wrong or analyzed it wrong for this one region of the country where the data doesn't seem quite right? And the whole team's like, yeah, you're right. That's what we should do. We should go back and recollect the data and reanalyze it and see what it looks like. So they do. They take the next week or so, and they go and they get this data. And then they come back together again in a meeting. Oh, man. I know, folks, you asked us to, you know, look at this data again, but I'm wondering what you think of it now that you've gotten to see it a second time around. Well, Larry, I mean, look at this data. It doesn't look any different than the first time around. You know he's right. It doesn't look good at all. And, Larry, I mean, if this data really is true, I mean, we need to do something about it. And what they were alluding to was the fact that in this one region of the country, there appeared to be an epidemic of hemorrhoids I mean, the epidemic was so huge and had been going on for so many years that the Center for Disease Control should have been notified, and nobody had done that. You know, what are you supposed to do if this gets out into the media? And once again, that little voice in the back of the room says, you know, before we go, like, to the sponsor and to the executive office and talk about this, maybe we should go to the head of claims, the woman who is responsible for all this data being collected. And the team's like, oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. So they do. They call her up on the phone. They arrange to go and visit with her. And Larry and a portion of the team show up, and they explain to her what they have found. That's my data. What are you doing looking at my data? Larry says to her, well, you know, that's not really your data. I mean, it's data that the company collects and puts into its different, you know, applications to review. That's our data. You're not supposed to be looking at our data. Geez, you guys don't understand, do you? Well, again, you know, I mean, the actuaries have to use that data to set rates, so they really need access to it. I'm not quite certain, you know, what you're talking about. Wow, you guys, we use that code. We use that code for our PETAs. Your PETA? Yeah, you know, the pain in the ass customers, when they call in and we think they're going to call back, we code them as PETA so we know how to handle them the second time around. Pretty good solution to a problem, what you say? And I said to Larry, I said, what did you do? And he said, well, he said, you know, I had just called in recently because I have insurance with this company, and I thought to myself, geez, am I a PETA? And he said, and then after I got over that, he said, we kind of like sat her down in a chair, and we said to her, you know, we understand that you want to have a way to understand difficult customers, but when you go and kind of manipulate data and add information in the way that you did, there are some unintended consequences to what you've done. And I said, well, how did she respond? He said, well, she kind of got it. He said, but the problem was that she'd been trying for a long time to get a system to help her, and nobody would listen to her. So when I heard this, I said to him, so what did you learn from this situation? I mean, what are you going to take away from it? And he said, you know, he said, what it really taught me, and I've never forgot, he said, is that you always have to consider the consequences. He said, every time you think you have the right solution to a problem, there's probably an unintended negative consequence that's associated with it, yet we never bother to figure out what it is. He said, so we really kind of need to step back and say, you know, what are all the consequences of the option that we're choosing? And, you know, I think today that's true for all of us here, too, right? I mean, we work with people in organizations on the stories they choose. We help them solve their problems. We think that we're bringing in the optimal solutions to help them too. But I think we all are also responsible for helping them to consider the consequences of their decisions.
That's great. I love that real life example of how you never, you know, be careful what you ask for, you may get it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what I love about the story is a couple things. One is in a, like a 800-page book on information quality, Larry talks about this example, but he does it all through data. And what I love is that we've been able over the years to shape a story with him that communicates some really critical messages and many layers of meaning, because when I talk to people about what are all the meanings you get from the story, I get like, you know, 10 or 12 of them. But he did it. We were able to craft a story without the data. And that to me is really, a demonstration to people that in the truest or ultimate of senses, that's what we want to really strive for. Notwithstanding that data might not be useful for contrast, but that there are other ways to describe situations to get the key points across to people so they know to shift their behavior.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. I'm curious, you know, you've always been a little bit ahead of your time and the kind of organizational change curve, as I call it. What do you see as being, you know, knowing what you see now and even maybe for us as storytellers, what do you see as being the next challenge for savvy leaders in an organization? Is it just learn how to tell a story or what do you think?
No, I think it's the subject that we've alluded to today, and I cannot begin to tell you the possibilities that I see here. I think it's helping people to transform data into a story. I had no idea, you know, when I said to Karen the other day, I called her up and I said, why did we put this chapter 8 in the book on this subject? Like, remind me, I am I'm very forgetful. And she said that she curates articles for Scoop It for her site every day that she sends out to us, and that she was starting to see articles coming out on this topic, but they weren't coming from the field of business storytelling. They were coming from people who are data scientists who are really struggling with this issue. And, you know, the articles are coming out, like, almost every single day. When I look at the number of articles that she's curated coming just out of Harvard Business Review and the blogs or CIO Magazine, even as of yesterday and today, they're growing through the roof. And I think that we've missed, up to this point, an opportunity to have a voice in the messaging, because these people are struggling with what does it mean to create narrative around story. And even insofar as, just as a case in point, there's a book that Wiley put out that they talk about. I can't remember the exact title, but it has to do with transforming data into story, and it's only about data visualization. And that's where it stops, as I mentioned earlier. And I think that one of the things I have found that's really, really beneficial to people, and it's easy to explain, is the data wisdom continuum, where raw data, you have to do something with raw data. Unless you're intuitively smart and can see patterns in raw data, which sometimes some of us are able to do, we have to do something with that data. Now, some of us might talk about, you know, is there what's the data quality of the data set that we're looking at? Does the data need to be cleansed? Does it need to be manipulated in any form? Maybe we're not going to look at the entire set of data, but we're going to look at a subset of it, and we're going to put it into a data warehouse, and then we're going to work with it and manipulate it in different ways. And that's really what we call information. But then when we move to knowledge and understanding, that's where I think data visualization comes in. And I feel really grateful for my experience. Oh, my gosh, now back, it takes me back to like the mid-80s into the early 90s, where I worked in the field of total quality management and had an opportunity to work with a company affiliated with Dr. Deming. And I had PhD statisticians around me. So I understand how data can be transformed into visualizations. That's where the data can actually start to speak to you. But that's still what we call sense making. When we move to wisdom, what is really the meaning of this information and what action needs to be taken as a result of this? That's where story in its truest sense comes into play. And I think that we have got to figure out how to join this conversation that's happening by leaps and bounds and bring our expertise to the table. I had an opportunity a week ago to teach a workshop, a full-day workshop on this in Toronto. I'm going to teach another workshop on it on June 11th in the Twin Cities. I can't believe the number of people that are signing up for it. It's just amazing. I've been interviewing attendees to try to understand the data that they have that they want to have speak to them. There's volumes of it, volumes and volumes and volumes. And I kind of thought that, I got naive, I guess, after a while. So I thought that people in the quality field were kind of helping people internally. You know, they were in their organizations to understand what the data was saying. And I'm recognizing that whole skill set is missing. And so I think we have a role to play. And I don't think we can wait to be invited to the table. I think we better start showing up and growth in our organization to start helping with this work. So that's kind of like, to me, that's really, really big. And then the other piece that's really big to me is that really, and I've spent some time now working on this a little bit. I wrote an article for the Association of Strategic Planning. I'm really trying to understand all the different types of stories that make up future stories. and to really help leaders. Because what I found when I was doing my CEO group last week in D.C. is that organizational change and story is a huge gap, and that these leaders are struggling mightily with how to do their messaging. And they could really benefit from the work that we've been doing in this area as well. And so, which is good for me because I'm like, ooh, you know, I'm glad to hear that they see a home for this. But the data piece too, I mean, they just, their eyes open wide up. They get like these cool looks on their faces, like, really? You know, I think we can make the data say something. But, you know, there's a flip side to this too, right? And the flip side is what I'm seeing happen, and it's scaring me half to death. And that is, I hear people say, well, let's start with the story when it comes to the data. Let's start with the story, and let's just back into finding the data to support it. And, oh, my, going back to your question on influence, I think we kind of might call that manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not doing too well with that. What I say to people is a data set might have 20 stories attached to it, and you better know what all of those different stories could potentially be, notwithstanding that you still may have 50 more after that. But if you start with the end in mind and you tell me that this is the story and the key message that you want and you're only going to go find the data that supports it, I don't do so well with that because I think we're going to have a lot of science folks coming at us and saying that's just not good. So I think we need to be careful about that. But there are some, you know, publications out there now that are starting to reference that as being acceptable. But I think it'll get us in hot water. There's some real ethical issues associated with that. But again, that's just from my vantage point. That may not
right.
be true from other people's vantage point.
So keeping the eye on the high road as you go through that is going to be critical and important. So great. That's great insight, Lori. Thank you. I want to make sure we give folks a chance to ask any other questions before we wrap up. Any other questions that are out there? Don't forget to unmute yourself in case you're trying to talk now. So I don't hear any other core questions. So with that, Lori, I just want to say thank you very much. We really appreciate your insight, and especially around tackling this thing called data, if you will, and how to leverage off of it in a way that can influence and shape decision making. So thank you, and especially for a number of the specific examples that you shared. I know, Lori. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I can say you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. And I know that Lori is actually going to be joining us again next month, entirely different subject. So look for more information around that. I don't know, Lori, if you want to, like, give people a little peek or if we should keep it under wraps for now.
Let's keep it under wraps until we get a date together, and then we can announce it, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. I know it's some of the cutting-edge stuff that you're working on, and so we want to save that. But just so you know, Lori's going to be back and talk about an entirely different subject, especially with some of the folks that she's been working with. So I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to end our recording, and then after that I'll just say some thank yous. But again, Lori, we really appreciate your time and all of your insight. And if you haven't had a chance to read some of what Lori has written, just Google her and you'll find that there's a plethora of things that are out there, including articles, the Business Storytelling for Dummies book that we talked about.
Hello.
Stories trainers tell. They're all very relevant. Wake me up before the data, when the data's over. So, you know, take a chance to take a look at that. And with that, I'll go ahead and I will end our recording. So if you just give me a quick second.